The House will come to order if members can take their seats.
This budget is a huge job maker, and the number one solution to economic insecurity is a job.
Hungry children can't learn, and it's our responsibility to try to help.
Equality and opportunity.
I believe most people are here because they want to do some good.
Welcome to a brand new installment of Capital Ideas. If you're new here, it's the podcast where members of the Majority House Democratic Caucus in the Washington State House of Representatives sit down at the Capitol and talk about ideas. Today, I'm joined by Representative Nicole Macri, who was sent here by the folks of the 43rd District, which comprises just about everything people picture when they think about Seattle. She's a longtime affordable housing advocate, among many other things, and here in Olympia, she serves as vice chair of the Budget Writing House Appropriations Committee. We're about to talk about all kinds of interesting things, so stay tuned. We recorded this on Thursday, February 20th, 2025, and it starts now. Representative Nicole Macri from the 43rd District in the heart of Seattle, thanks for coming by on Capital Ideas.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here.
I often start off with a general question like, what do you want to talk about today? But in this case, I kind of know what we want to at least start with, which is the fact that Washington is far underwater when it comes to affordable housing. And it's something that has occupied the legislature for several sessions. The problem isn't solved yet. What's going on this session that you think is going to chip away? Should these bills be successful?
Yeah, first I'll start by saying that we've made tremendous progress in both our policies and investments in recent years. But at the same time, the challenges related to affordable housing have only increased. So while we're getting better, the problem is growing. And so we've got to get smarter and faster and bolder if we are really going to solve the challenges that our residents across the state are having. So the challenge we see is that the cost of housing continues to outpace the increases in incomes for Washingtonians, and that's true across the state. So this is a problem that was once really concentrated in our higher cost urban areas of the state, but now we hear from folks all over the state. More and more, we're hearing about problems like private equity firms purchasing up single-family homes and apartment buildings, so out-of-state money coming in, really treating housing as a commodity, not folks who are rooted in community. This is a particular problem for manufactured housing communities where there's been a huge wave of private equity investment and an incredibly rapid increase in rents for the land that people have their manufactured homes on. That is a challenge that is contributing to the rapid increase in rents and in impacting the overall real estate market. We have a number of different policies that we have been working on. Of course, for many years, I have been working on rent stabilization policy, and we are building more momentum than ever before. In fact, new pollings come out just in the last week that shows that 72% of Washington voters support rent stabilization policy. And a majority of folks have concerns around limiting those protections to only older units. And so some of the debate that we've heard is about, you know, what's the nuance of the policy and how we should, you know, what kinds of tenants or what kinds of properties will have protections related to rent stabilization and which ones won't. And it's just interesting that the debates that sometimes happen here in Olympia aren't always as informed by where the public is as we think our debates are. There's a lot of special interests here with strong presence in the halls of the State House. And it's really important for us as representatives of our communities to really listen to our constituents on issues like this. So why have I been so passionate about rent stabilization? First of all, my district has more renters than any other district in the state. That is not surprising since I represent a number of neighborhoods in and around downtown Seattle. And we have both the highest proportion and the highest number of renters. And of course, it is one of the highest cost areas of the state. So we have a huge number of people who are rent burdened, meaning they are paying more than 30% and often more than half of their income on their rent. And this is becoming unsustainable. And over the past several years, while rent increases, particularly in the last year, have been tempering somewhat, I've heard too many stories about double-digit percentage rent increases that are debilitating people's ability to meet their own basic needs. Hearing this particularly from seniors, from people with disabilities, from families with young kids, and it has such an impact not only on what individuals and families can do to make their lives manageable, but it has impacts on the community in general. So when you've got to move because you can't afford the rent, and you got to pull your kid out of school and put them in a new school, that impacts their ability to keep pace with school. It impacts their social, emotional connectivity in building relationships with their educators and with their peers. Same is true when people's commutes have to get longer and longer to get to work. You know, we talk a lot about what we do here in Olympia to help promote people's ability to get into home ownership. So that is a big problem that young people cannot afford to buy their own homes. And so more and more people are renting because of the high cost of purchasing housing. But also the high cost of rent is preventing people from saving money to be able to put down a down payment and get into a home. And so the need to put some common sense protections in place around how rapidly and how high rents can increase is an important policy, not just for the specific people who will be protected by that kind of policy, but for all of us, because it really helps bring stability to all of our communities.
I'm sure that employers would be really concerned about the fact that they lose employees when people have to increase a commute by an hour. A lot of people are going to say, the heck with it. I'm going to find a job closer to my new, even though it's not very affordable, more affordable apartment.
That's exactly right. And the other issue is when somebody's housing is unstable, because the rent goes up and they have to scramble to find a new place to live, their productivity at work goes down. And so I think it is, in terms of workforce stability and employers' interests, housing stability is key. And this bill would bring some more predictability to families across our state.
Let me be the devil's advocate for a minute here and just ask, from a landlord's point of view, particularly a landlord maybe who's raising the rent on a place that's been affordable for a long time by a pretty exorbitant amount, what is the justification that they offer? Are they under some sort of gun that is causing this to kind of be reasonable? Is it completely unreasonable? What's the argument against rent stabilization?
There's several different arguments that I have heard, but one is that, you know, landlords need flexibility to increase the rent because they are managing cost increases, the cost of property taxes, the cost of utilities, the cost of property insurance. All of those things go up and they're outside the control of our property owners. And all of that is true. So the fact that we have negotiated and gotten to this point of a 7% annual limit on rent increases has been carefully considered. The majority of expense that property owners have when they are renting out their properties is the mortgage, right? The monthly payment they have to make, which is a stable payment over a long period of time. The variable costs that they have, by comparison, are much smaller. Those monthly expenses for utilities, property tax, insurance are much smaller than their mortgage payment. And so when you say 7%, and I've heard some landlords say to me, well, my property taxes went up more than 7%, or my utilities went up more than 7%, repair and maintenance, another ongoing cost to maintain a property, those costs would have to go up 30, 40% in order for the overall cost of operating that unit to go up more than 7%. So 7% is a number we've come up with because it provides that ongoing stability for our renter families and individuals across the state while still providing a healthy margin for property owners to both maintain their properties and make money. Because, of course, it is true that people rent out properties in order to make money, and we don't want to prevent that from happening.
This bill does not tie a landlord's hands when a property comes up for rental. This is a 7% raise on an existing tenant, correct?
Correct. Yeah, the intent is to provide stability for people in their current housing, and it does allow, when somebody moves out of the unit, for a landlord to reset the rent at any amount.
And given that there have been compromises on both sides now to arrive at House Bill 1217, what are the prospects this year? I know that rent stabilization came very close last session, didn't quite get to the finish line. What's going to happen this year in your crystal ball?
Yeah, so last year, the House passed the bill to the Senate, and very lively debate in the Senate about the bill, but did not get to the finish line. This year, there has been much more momentum built around this bill, and we are quite optimistic that we will see a bill get to the governor's desk this year. So we have a bill at this point in the process that is in the Rules Committee and ready to be pulled to the House floor to be sent over to the Senate. And the Senate is also considering a version of the bill. It has just moved out of the Senate Housing Committee, and the majority leader and many members of the Senate have said that they anticipate that the bill will proceed. So the real question this year is, will there be further compromise in the policy, and what will that look like? And so what that debate has really been about, I think, is finding that right balance. The bill as it is right now is, I think, quite balanced, providing that stability for tenants while not impeding property owners' ability to make a reasonable profit on their properties. But, you know, as always in Olympia, there are different perspectives on what the right balance is.
Let me jump to a different housing topic here, which is the supply of housing. I've heard many, many statistics. One is that Washington needs to build 1 million new housing units in the next 2 decades. They need to build 200,000 in the next 4 years. With as many housing bills as there are this session, I know that you don't have them all memorized, but in general, do you see movement in the supply side of this question?
Yeah, there are a number of great bills that are being considered this year, and Washington State is at a great deficit in the number of housing units we have. By some measures, we are the worst in the nation, meaning that we have the greatest undersupply of housing of any state in the country. And so we need to do multiple things to both invest in housing for people who are lower income, as well as create an environment where the private market will build more housing. We've made great strides in recent years. There are a few bills that are sort of percolating to the top in terms of attention this year. One of them that we've been considering for the last 3 or so years has been the transit-oriented development bill to incentivize the creation of denser housing in areas where we have made public investments in transit infrastructure, right? So where there are places where it's easy for people to move around because we are building either train, light rail, or bus infrastructure in our state, we should be incentivizing places for more people to live. And that bill's made some great strides. in its considerations. It's moved out of the Housing Committee, and it includes some incentives and requirements to ensure that as we build out more housing, we're ensuring that some portion of that housing is affordable, particularly to lower and middle income people. So that's an exciting bill. The lot splitting bill, which would allow property owners to divide their property to be able to build and sell multiple units on a single parcel, is an exciting one that's gotten consideration over the last 2 years, and I'm hopeful we'll get that to the governor's desk this year. The Senate just sent us Senator Bateman's parking requirements bill, so lowering the requirements to build parking spots when you're building multifamily housing, that is really important because requiring parking spots just adds to the cost of development. So what I like to say is, like, do we have a housing crisis or do we have a parking crisis? And there are some things that some jurisdictions may think are nice to have, but we've really got to think about the challenge that we need to address right now. There are several other bills, including building more housing in rural areas. We have seen challenges in cost increases, not just in the urban and suburban centers, but in the rural areas of our state as well. So allowing some limited ability to build some accessory dwelling units on properties in rural areas, that has been some, there's been some consideration on that. As you say, some estimates are that we need to build over 1 million housing units over the next 2 decades, half of which need to be affordable to the lowest income people in our state. So we've got to build a lot, and the state's got to be a major contributor to how that happens, because the private market just isn't going to support the needs of the lowest income people to the full extent that we need housing for our community members.
I think we could talk about housing for about another hour or three, but I want to get in some other things during this short time I've got your attention. You are sponsoring many bills, some having to do with housing and many having to do with other things. And you're also vice chair of what is the most key committee on this campus right now, which is the House Appropriations Committee. This is going to be a really challenging, tough budget year. And I know that you're hard at work on that. What's going on? I'm not asking for details, but I would love to hear a big picture.
Yeah, so we have the most sizable shortfall in the state budget that we have seen since the Great Recession of over a decade ago. And there are multiple factors that have contributed to that. Most notably is we've got huge demand for state services in our state, and the cost of delivering services has gone up because of inflation, because the cost of everything, as we know, has gone up. At the same time, we have seen a tempering in the increases in our state tax revenue. That's partly because we are really dependent on consumption-based taxes like sales taxes. And we're somewhat more vulnerable than other states that as consumer kind of consumption, purchasing of goods goes down, our tax revenues plummet faster than in some other states that might have a more diversified tax code. And so that regressive tax code is coming back again to cause great challenges for us. But the demand for the kinds of things the state funds is up, and the cost to deliver those services is up. Most notably, public education. That is the paramount duty of the state and an area that we spend a lot of time talking about when we talk about the state budget, but a variety of other state services as well. So we are working to, of course, bring the state budget into balance, because right now those expense pressures for demand plus inflation are not matching the resources that we have coming in. So we are both looking at how do we make tough choices about the most important things the state needs to fund in service to residents across the state. And we are looking at those things that keep people alive and healthy, make sure people have food and shelter, are able to meet their basic needs. Looking at things like making sure that we are funding our K-12 education system, making sure that we're providing essential healthcare services, especially to low-income residents across the state. making sure the folks who are hitting hard times have those emergency support services that we provide, like emergency housing or our temporary assistance for needy family support, et cetera. It is a very challenging dynamic right now. And we have a new governor who has, of course, just begun and has begun at a time, absorbing this great budget challenge. So a lot of lively conversation about the best way to address sizable challenge. I am confident that Democrats are going to keep the needs of Washingtonians front of mind as we come out with our budget proposal. In terms of process, the House Democratic and Senate Democratic budget teams are putting together budget proposals that they will share broadly towards the end of March that will come after what we call the March revenue forecast, where our state economist provides us a forecast on what our tax revenues will look like over the next few years. Then we will have hearings on those two proposals, one in the House, one in the Senate, and then our negotiations on a final budget, reconciling any differences between House and Senate proposals will occur.
How about some of your bills, Nicole? What's going on with the fact that you represent the people of the 43rd District? You write legislation about a number of issues, healthcare, housing, obviously, behavioral health.
Yeah, well, I have bills in all of those areas this session. I'm really working, as I have for many years, on the affordability of healthcare. This is an issue I've heard from my constituents in the 43rd, but also from folks around the state, that the cost of healthcare is exorbitant and causes great hardship for too many people. So I have been working on a policy, particularly for public and school employees, that would bring more access and affordability in insurance coverage for our public employees. This is a trend we've seen across the nation of how do we temper the amounts that insurance companies are paying for healthcare services because our healthcare inflation rate far exceeds the general inflation rate. I have a bill around behavioral health crisis response services and how the state can structure those services and support local communities in the deployment of those services. We've seen more and more people in need of behavioral health crisis response services and communities struggling to provide those services. So I have a bill about that. I just recently, in light of the horrific directives from the federal government and our president, highly biased and bigoted targeting, particularly of our transgender and non-binary young people in Washington state and across the country, I've introduced a bill to ensure that people can get access to needed care, including hormone replacement therapy, by allowing 12-month access to that. I've heard from folks, particularly immigrants, people in rural areas, who are now afraid to even go to the pharmacy and get their medications. They're afraid that they may not be able to continue to retain a healthcare provider who will take care of them. So making sure that folks can get their medications is important because these medications, hormone replacement or other hormone therapies, can be really life-saving medications for many people. So those are just a few of the bills that I'm working on. I actually have a number of bills this year, but those are just a few highlights.
Representative Macri, we are at the half hour mark here on our conversation. I know that you've got something coming up in the next 3 minutes or so. How do you want to end this conversation today?
You know, I think this session, to me, this is my ninth session, my ninth year in the legislature, and this session feels like the highest stakes to me. With all the uncertainty and harmful rhetoric coming out of the federal government, I have heard from thousands of my constituents about the need for reassurance that Washington is going to continue to protect them, protect their civil rights, protect their access to the care and services that they need and protect their ability to find opportunity and thrive in their lives. At the same time, the state is facing real financial challenges. And I feel like this session is going to be one where Democrats are being called upon to stand up for our constituents in a way that we just haven't been called to do before. And I'm really grateful and inspired by what we are doing this session and how seriously we are taking this task. So I'm optimistic that we will deliver good results, both for my constituents, but for folks across the state. And I'm just really honored and just so humbled and grateful that I get to play this role on behalf of my neighbors here in the State House.
I'm really glad you do, Nicole, and I'm really glad that you had a half an hour today to talk with me and the folks listening to Capital Ideas. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks so much.
This was a good one. If you haven't subscribed to Capital Ideas, you can do so on your favorite platform or on the House Democratic Caucus website at housedemocrats.wa.gov. Hit media at the top, and from there, it's pretty easy. I hope you will, because in every episode, we talk with people like Nicole Macri, people who are working for you, doing their best to keep Washington the best place there is to live, work, and raise a family. This is your state government, and what happens here is more important today than ever before. I'm Dan Frizzell for the Washington State House Democrats, putting people first since 1889, the year a total solar eclipse frightened people in California and Nevada. Thanks for your time.